We are having a conversation today that is very difficult to have, and it pales in comparison to how difficult it is for the ladies who have been involved in this. And I got to bring this up now because we have Drew on the line. Drew Dixon joins us. Hey, Drew, how you doing this morning?
I am blessed. I'm grateful, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
No, it's great to have you on with us. I know we have a little fuzzy signal going on here, but I wanted to make sure that we didn't miss out an opportunity to talk to you this morning, because you've told your story with this documentary, and I would just tell you the first thing that came to mind is when I heard the words "price of admission," and that's when it tugged on my heart, because like hip hop has always been this thing where the kids were finally invited to the conference room. And they were able to come in with this format that was like our thing, and to have that access, and then to realize there's another cost attached to it, kind of like, you know, broke my heart. And I want to start there, like that. When you said that, that kind of really meant something.
Well, I want to give all credit to Dr. Joan Morgan, because she was the one who actually said that. I'm so grateful that the film included the voices of these amazing Black women who are scholars and journalists, who I read before I even got to New York and got my opportunity to do the thing I wanted to do, which was to make rap records. So that was Joan dropping the science there. You know, I don't think I understood in the moment that there was, quote-unquote, a price. I really thought that if I just worked really hard and kept my head down and delivered hits, that I could sort of, you know, I could be rewarded on the strength of my contribution as a professional, as a creative executive. And I knew that it was tough. I knew that it was rough and rugged. I knew that it was a boys' club. So I knew I had to overcome misogyny, and I didn't want to, like, seem like I couldn't handle it. So I didn't want to complain. But I don't think I understood that the environment and the language that I thought just meant I had to have a thick skin also meant I was exposed to this other layer of danger that honestly blindsided me, and I just wasn't prepared for that.
Now, we're on with Drew Dixon. On the Record is the documentary. If you haven't seen it, I would suggest you do it, just as a fan of hip-hop, because it's, you've had a hand in so many things that we, you know, we were talking about the Meth and Mary. We were talking about the fact that, you know, just the stuff that's mentioned. And I'm like, yo, these are ones that have stood the test of time.
Right.
Like, you look at that record. That's the first Ride or Die record. Wow. And the way you described how it was pieced together, that and the show and things that, you know, the fact of holding up the Junior Mafia cassette tape. I'm like, she's been present through all this. It's kind of like you would wish that this didn't happen. And I was reaching out to one of my good friends who's a program director elsewhere. And she said, you know what? It's not like, you know, people always earn their position. Sometimes they fall into it. And because these great people had fallen into these big positions in hip hop, we hold them on a high regard, but then we kind of see what's behind it now.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, when you get a hot hand and you have some hits and you're a man, or, you know, you are somehow invited into the club, they just keep betting on you. And, you know, this is a Black genre that was fueled by white money, ultimately. I mean, that's how it became as big as it became. And I'm looking back now and I'm thinking, maybe it's not a coincidence that some of the people that really got to win big were reinforcing stereotypes and images that were really harmful to our community. And I was so happy that hip-hop wasn't playing the respectability politics game, which I think is a trap for us, this idea that, oh, if I dress a certain way, if I act a certain way, I'll be safe. Like, no, like, it's a systemic racist society, and that's a trick. If you think, you know, there's something you can actually really do with your hands that's really going to make sure you get out of an altercation or an encounter with the police or a vigilante racist person who wants to act like they're the police, that's a myth. I mean, I have a Black son, and I have had the talk with him. But I also really just have to pray, because at the end of the day, it's not about what he does with his hands. And I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I've had the talk with her about how to handle herself, but it's also not really about what she wears or how respectful she is. It's about people that take advantage of you, and I really look back now and I wonder if the people who had hits that got rewarded and powered and supported were the ones that sort of reinforced this non-threatening, self-destructive imagery of who we were. And maybe, you know, I wasn't willing to play the game. I just thought, I'll have hits, and I always try to make records that reflected an aspect of our life experience that was more uplifting and positive. I made a lot of records with women, you know, and even the interlude, the Method Man interlude. I mean, when I took over the Method Man album, it was essentially done. The Cal was really done. I heard the interlude, though, and I was like, oh, my God, this is the most beautiful, like, ode to a woman in the vocabulary of hip-hop that I'd ever heard. You know, I was dating a hip-hop head, like, you know, separately, like, in my private life, and it reminded me kind of our relationship, and that's why I fought so hard for them to give me a shot at making this duet that really was the remix with Mary, because I thought it was important to show that aspect of hip-hop, and I just wonder if maybe that's not really the version of us and of our voice and our life experience that, you know, maybe the powers that be wanted to win. And so, yeah.
It was, I mean, to see the records, and I mean, the way you talked about the female influence of it, a lot of us in this game who have made sure that women were represented around us in this, in trying to make radio palatable or trying to make records palatable. I've always had female music directors because I felt like having a room full of men couldn't really put it together the right way. And to look at your discography, to look at A Rose Is Still a Rose from Aretha Franklin and Lauryn Hill, like that's a record where a woman out there is like, ooh, she was involved with that. You know, like, or My Love Is Your Love, Whitney Houston and Clef. Like, you know, those records that had a lot of soul to it, you realize that a woman had to touch those records. And for those to come through you as a vessel, that had to be laid out before you just jump onto the fact of why these moments were stolen from you. And I have to say that, you know, when I talked to Ryan and I was talking about the urgency to get it on and to do this conversation, it was more so because of how you described that, really shockingly, that you didn't want to come forward.
I did not. Oh, my God.
You didn't want to come forward because you were protecting black men.
Well, I understand that, you know, there's only so much information that the white mainstream can even digest as far as it comes to, like, a story about a black person or black people. And if Russell Simmons Is a Rapist became a headline, the king of hip-hop, a genre that at the time that I worked at Def Jam didn't even have a category in the Grammys. I mean, the genre itself was not a given to survive. And I loved it so much, and I love my people so much. You know, I just felt like, the last thing I want to do, I mean, when I was at Def Jam, the OJ verdict came out, and we cheered so much, I thought the building might come down. I mean, you know, obviously, we know more about what happened in that case. You know, that was 1994, right? So, but it was like this notion of, like, a win for our side. And I didn't want to be anywhere around a story that was a negative for us that could then put a target, a bigger target on the back of innocent black men and boys, because they would have another headline, another boogeyman that they could use to somehow rationalize being violent and incarcerating black men and boys who are going about their business, living their best lives, or trying, but are perceived to be dangerous. And so until I realized there were other women and it wasn't just me, and it was not about just me trying to bury it, that it was really about other women needing somebody to speak up when he called them liars, that's what pushed me over the edge. It was more about my sisters as opposed to just thinking narrowly about this one icon who I didn't want to lose, because I understand the importance of symbolism and role models for us as people.
Yeah. Javi, you wanted to ask Drew a question.
Drew, since coming forward with your story, have you received, like, backlash and people, you know, saying that they don't necessarily believe you, or why did you wait so long? Like, what are some of the worst aspects of coming forward?
Well, As far as backlash, it's more crickets than backlash. There's a lot of silence from people in the music industry that I knew, who I worked with, where I was instrumental in putting them on and giving them a, you know, an opportunity to work with big artists. And I'm shocked at the silence from so many of those people who I thought just on the personal level would at least reach out. Some people have reached out privately, but then I see on social media they're still supporting, you know, Russell, and so they're kind of trying to, like, have it both ways. You know, I also see more, you know, harsh comments aimed at me and the other survivors in social media from people I don't know. You know, Russell Simmons went on The Breakfast Club and smeared us, like, just made up stuff, and, like, nobody pushed back against him. So the thing I think that really is the most sort of frustrating to me is when I see people saying we're liars because we didn't go to the police, you know, or we're liars because we're trying to have this tried in the court of public opinion. First of all, I'm not trying to have anything tried anywhere. I'm just trying to get this burden off of my back and off of the back of these other women, because I realize that you're like kept in a little cage. Like, I became an accessory after the fact to his crime. I'm out here picking up his bloody gloves. Every time for 22 years I told a story about my career, and I went out of my way to omit anything that might remotely expose him, I'm out here doing his work. I'm harming myself again. And I was just trying to get free. I'm not trying to try anybody's anything anywhere. But it is crazy to me that the same police that are racist, you know, are the people I'm supposed to call. You know, I'm not Amy Cooper. I'm a black woman. I don't just call the police. I don't necessarily think that's the solution. And the criminal justice system that we know is racist and unfair is suddenly the arbiter of my truthfulness in my community. Like, how does that work?
Yeah.
How do we suddenly think that's the answer for me as a black woman when we know good and well that's not the answer for us as black people, period?
Like, you don't want to run to the police and say that's the protector that you need when there's so many people who are aware of it around you, is what you're saying. And you're like, there should be
so many people. I just want him to stop. You know, we're talking about a decades-long crime spree of rape. That's what we're talking about here. And we're talking about premeditated, calculated traps that this man set to lure us into private spaces where he physically and violently, in my case, attacked me. And, you know, I just want him to not harm people, and I want to send a message to other survivors so they don't think they're not, that they don't matter, that their pain isn't real, that there is a safe space within our community for survivors to come forward, and I'm including black women, girls, and boys and men, because you know how we stop this cycle? We don't just speak up for the victims. We speak up not just for the women, but for the men, because we create more abusers. We create more predators if this cycle continues. I don't think any of these men were born bad. You know, R. Kelly was a survivor. I don't know Russell's past, but I'm assuming he was harmed. And so if we don't stop the cycle, we're not just creating more women who are victims and more men and boys who are victims. We're creating more perpetrators, and we're keeping ourselves broken, which frankly is doing half the job of white supremacy, because the longer we stay broken, the longer it's going to take us actually to overcome. So I'm doing this from love. When I tell you I love hip-hop, I love it. When I tell you I love my people, I love my people. When I tell you I love my men and my boys, I want us to stop hurting ourselves.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that you were able to open up and tell your story. I watched your documentary, and it's absolutely fantastic. I want everybody to go out there and watch it. It's on HBO Max. I do have a question for you. I feel like this does happen all the time, especially with young women at work, maybe without any experience. It could happen at any age, of course. But if you have like one message to any woman at any age that's listening right now or dealing with this themselves, what would you have to say to them?
You know, I thought about this a lot. I've been asked what advice I would give to a young woman entering any career, but especially a male-dominated career, you know, or any situation, frankly, where you are now, you know, responsible for your own safety. I would say, this sounds crazy, email yourself. The first time somebody does something that makes you feel a little bit sideways, a little bit like, that was weird, that comment was off, email yourself. And then if they do it again, email yourself again in the same thread. Now, if you've got 5 emails, I want you to compare the first email to the 5th email. And I want to see how far from your original north compass point you have gotten. Because predators groom you. They break you down. Russell did little things, and then he apologized. And then he would do something that was a little bit worse, and then he'd apologize. If you have no one to tell, tell yourself. Compare where you were, you know, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago, to where you are, you know, later. And if it's gotten that far where you really feel like you've almost like been like turned around and sort of really lost your grounding, forward those emails to somebody. Because now you've got a paper trail for yourself. You don't have to re-traumatize yourself by talking about it. Send that email chain to somebody until somebody says, wait a minute, this isn't right. You need to get out of the situation. In my case, I was trying to have a hit record with my name on the back to quit and get away from him. The first one I made was the duet, and I forgot to tell them I should get a credit. I mean, duh, it was my idea, but I didn't.
Was so infantile, though. You didn't know to say, hey, I need to have my name on it. Like, you know, they would know.
So on the show soundtrack, I typed the credits myself, and I was like, co-executive producer, Russell Simmons and Drew Dixon. Boom, send.
Yeah.
I made sure I got that credit, and I was going to start looking for another job when the record debuted at number 1 on the R&B chart, number 4 on the pop chart, and the record had been on the top of the chart for a few weeks when Russell said, come upstairs and grab this demo. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I really, you know, I mean, even now I look back, like, I had my ticket out of there, away from that harassment when the assault happened, and it's just devastating to me because I was trying to get out. And so
we're on with Drew Dixon, who is one of the principals of On the Record, which is on HBO Max. It's the story of the women who have come forward with their dealings of Russell Simmons and the hip hop world. It's Me Too, the hip hop edition, if you want to be real. Davi, you wanted to ask us something.
Drew, Russell Simmons has now moved to Indonesia. He's kind of out of the public spotlight and just like the scrutiny that you would get. Is there a sense that he got away with this?
You know, I do try not to think about him too much because I just don't have any control over what happens to him. I'm outside of the statute of limitations. You know, I don't think he's gotten away with it because Russell Simmons has to wake up every day and live with himself. I mean, just the exhaustion of the lies and even when I saw him in the Breakfast Club, I mean, I was furious. But I was also like, wow, what a way to live. Like, you may have all the money in the world, and you're doing your little crisscross applesauce yoga poses, whatever it is you're doing. I wake up every day, and I'm at peace. I don't have to, like, construct an elaborate story. You know, I don't have hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't even have one. But I have my integrity. And so did he get away with it? I don't know. He can't get away from himself. So, you know, that's a bad look, you know, to live like that. And, you know, I struggle with the criminal justice system. I really do. You know, I really am trying to think more forward. How do we have a conversation? Exactly what you guys are doing today. I'm so grateful for it. If one survivor hears this and understands that he or they deserve to be safer and protected, and they come forward and they stop the cycle in their own life and they get free, that's worth it to me. I really just want the next generation to avoid this trauma that we inherited. We experienced so much brutality as black people in this country, including sexual violence, and we just have taken it all and absorbed it all, and we just suck it up and we keep it moving because we haven't had a choice. I think much more about healing and moving forward than I do about him, because he's just beyond my control.
Drew Dixon is on the phone with us. On the Record is the documentary. It's on HBO Max. It's really, like I said, if you love hip hop, it's something that it has to be a part of your watching.
Yeah.
I will say that it's hard for me because when I see, like, I'm reading a book by Dorothy Carvello called Anything for a Hit. And it's talking about the Armand Aragon days and the Doug Morris days. And there's mention of Sylvia Rhone being one of the nationals at the time. Mm-hmm. And I look at the fact that you had Kanye West and you had John Legend in the lobby waiting to be seen so they could be signed.
Right.
And you couldn't get them in to meet with L.A. Reid because...
Kanye got in, and then he auditioned, and then L.A. said, he sucked, it was an embarrassment. I am not only was Kanye a pass, but I am terrible at my... You are bad at your job, Drew.
You're bad at your job for bringing Kanye West in and wasting his time.
Wow.
Wasting his time.
And this was after you had refuted his advances.
Correct. This is after I refused to... I just basically stopped answering his phone when he would call me at night when I was in the studio because I knew he was going to ask me to come to his hotel. And, you know, it started when I actually had this artist, Toya, a young woman out of St. Louis.
She did I Do. I know. That was I Do. That was the record.
I Do. It was the number one Churban record in America, contemporary hit urban crossover record in America. It was testing. Call It Research was through the roof. We were on our way. Album was done. LA loved the album. And we were going to try to make her, you know, this was like, she was like meant to be like a Rihanna type, like star. And he wanted me to come to his hotel to listen to her album. That was the first time he asked me. And I just started blowing him off. I just stopped answering his call. I would let it roll the voicemail and sort of like not bring it up the next day at work. And I was in a meeting with him, and the promotion staff was saying how big I Do was at radio, and let's gear up for this next single. And, you know, we really think we have a live one here. And we were supposed to listen to the album or some cuts from the album in the meeting, so that her name was the number one on the printed agenda. And he said, I want everyone to take out your pen and draw a line through Toya's name. And they looked at me down the table, and he said, I was listening to her album in my hotel room last night. And he just stared at me, and he said, I don't like it anymore. We're not chasing that record. And everyone was like, wait, but it's blowing up. And he was like, we are not chasing this artist.
Wow.
So he not only shut me down. You know, Toya is a stay-at-home mom. She's an awesome woman and has an awesome life. And her son is a dope athlete and, you know, whatever. But, like, Toya could have been Rihanna. Like, she was on that track, you know? Like, she had a huge record. And I never told her why. I mean, Toya reached out to me after this story became public. This artist I signed at Def Jam named Kali Rank didn't know for 22 years why I quit in the middle of his album. And so... Yeah, I just, like, I wasn't willing to play that game. I worked hard, I made hits, and I kept thinking it would be enough. And when it just clearly wasn't enough, and when L.A. just absolutely dragged me for auditioning Kanye, and then he wouldn't even audition John, I was just like, I can't win this game. I mean, I don't know how many more hits I can have. You know, I don't know what I need to do.
That's the part that hurts me, though, because, like, I know I'm good with Sylvia. Like, we're tight, and I've seen her ascent, and I've helped her through our careers. And I'm like, with the plethora of artists that you dealt with and made available, if you removed the game from the process, you might have been, and I mean, Drew Dixon would have been on your door, but I'm saying you might have been Sylvia Rhone.
People used to say that to me all the time. You're the next Sylvia Rhone. You're the next Sylvia Rhone. And I admired Sylvia when I came to New York. I tried to get a meeting with her. It took me like 11 attempts. And I finally got a meeting with her. And she's, you know, always been supportive. You know, like I would see her at events and she would always say she was proud of me. You know, I never worked with her directly. You know, there was just not an opening, you know, by the time I got that 11th. Plot, and I finally got in her office for like 10 minutes. She just didn't have any job for me, so I was a receptionist at the time at a rap management company called Empire. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I wanted to sit at that table and help make choices that would make hits, believe me. I'm
But deserving to be at that table, not just be wanting to be there, but deserving.
Of hits, like hit after, I mean, I came back to the business for 2 years after I quit. John Legend hired me to run his label. Estelle had made an album.
Like American
John
Boy. Yeah, done. That's you. That's
you. Like, it's not done. You got to call your boy Will I Am. I'm going to call my boy Kanye. We made American Boy. My son is in the video at the end. Like, you know, boom. I was like, wow, I still have it.
Can
like,
you imagine at the award show, they're like, we're getting ready to give an award to the woman who has brought us everything from Estelle, American Boy, John Legend, Kanye West, Maria from Santana in Wyclef.
Nobody's supposed to be here for Deborah Cox.
Right. No, Deborah Cox. Heartbreak Hotel, Whitney Houston. I'm like, come on. Like, with Kelly Price. Q-Tip. I mean, you know, she's giving us all these records. Let's hand her the trophy. Drew Dixon. Like, you would expect that to happen on an award show.
10 years. Like, I was just getting started, and I love making records. I'm like the person who kind of just sits in the back of the room at the club. I'm kind of shy. I'd rather be in the studio, but I love to see when the record I help to make is just absolutely moving the crowd. And I also love to see the artists find their traction and shine. That's why my relationship with Biggie was so cool. I would always kind of like head nod at him, and he would head nod at him. I was like, all right, okay, we're doing it, you know. and like, you know, and executives, you know, like Clive Davis would always get mad at me. He's like, your meetings are too long. Because when I would meet with an artist, even when I passed, I would be like, okay, wait a minute. First of all, I don't see this happening, but you know how big of a deal it is that you're in my office. You know how much you've already won. You know how much of a winner you are. What's your favorite subject in school? What do you like to do? Like, I was like, I must make sure this young person walks out of my office with the wind at their back. You know, like, that's why when L.A. dressed me down for, like, being bad at my job and Kanye was in the lobby, I was like, can I just tell him? Like, this man is waiting, you know? And I was like, yo, you are going to win so many Grammys. This is not even about you. You know, this is about some other that is bullshit.
Okay,
all right, don't say that. that hip-hop. That hip-hop comes out, don't it?
Drew, were you concerned about losing your job after everything that had happened privately in Russell's bedroom? I mean, yeah. I know you quit, but were you expected to get fired?
I stayed home for a month. I didn't even realize that, but I had a friend who was staying on my couch. She was the one in my apartment the night it came home, and I thought I stayed home for like a week. She's a girl, it was a month. You were home for 5 weeks, girl. You just did not come. You didn't leave the apartment. You just stopped going to work. And then one day she said you left and you came back and you'd gotten all your hair cut off. And then I did go back to work for like a week, and Russell came into the office. I think I went in actually for the signing photo of this artist Capleton that I signed. And that photo was in the film.
The Capleton tour, the tour record.
Yeah, yeah. And we did a remix. Little John did a remix for us with Method Man, Wings of the Morning. And I look really sad in that picture. It's in the movie. And I came in only because I wanted to do my signing photo. I mean, Capleton was my signing. And Russell came in for the signing photo. And I think it was maybe the first time I saw him. I don't remember. It was all a blur. I was in such a dark place. And he asked me to sit in his lap. And that's when I was like, oh my God. Like I just was like, wow. And that's, I went home and I wrote two handwritten letters of resignation, one that I dropped off at Def Jam for Lior, and one that I dropped off in the lobby of Russell's building because he didn't have an office at Def Jam. And literally, when I tell you, I couldn't even cross out my mistakes. I mean, I couldn't even start again, so I just crossed out my mistakes and continued because I was so weak that I couldn't even physically write. I couldn't even start a new paper, you know, and make it all the way through without messing up. This was my dream job. I'd answer phones at Jive Records, Warner Brothers Records. I was a receptionist at Empire Management. I then did publishing for 10 months for Zomba, where I signed Nas, his publishing, before Illmatic came out, and Eric Sermon's publishing. Then I got the Def Jam job. And I couldn't believe my dream job was ending like this. And so I just quit, and I was going to quit the business. I mean, I for real was going to just leave New York and just give up. And, you know, then I started getting phone calls because I had the number one record. I mean, the show soundtrack stayed at number one for a really long time. And I got meetings. You know, I met with Doug Morris. I met with, you know, Tommy Mottola. I mean, I met with everybody, and I was just bitter. I just didn't even want to do it anymore. And then I met with Clive, and it's like I melted. He's a music guy. He just started playing new records, and his face lit up, and then my face lit up, and I just loved Clive, you know? And at the time, he was closeted, but I can say it now, he's gay. And so my most successful career sort of period was working for 4.5 years for like the older gay dudes. So there was no complications. We just made joints together.
It was very funny that people picked on me about this, but I would tell you, I spent years with Clive calling him Uncle Clive because we're both Davises, and I had no idea he was gay. I had no idea. And when I found out, I was like, really? You couldn't tell me? He's like, it's not something that was discussed, Orlando.
You know, I was in the A&R department at Arista. I probably shouldn't say this, but some people jokingly called it the gay in our department because it was like everybody there was like pretty much like a white gay man. And then there was like one older straight dude named Michael Berrickman and me. So I was the only black person. I was the only woman. I was one of the only two straight people, and I was the only person under 30. I was just like representing.
Hits were coming out of there, though. So
yes. Crazy.
Now, Drew, let me. There's so much. First of all, I want to invite you. I have never done this because I just started doing this, but I just launched a podcast, and I want to invite you as one of my guests because I have so much music stuff. I have so much music stuff that I just want to sit and talk to you about because every song on your discography like got a plug in my heart. So I want to make sure we do that. So I'm gonna reach out to Ryan for that. But I want to thank you for, because there are people out there who want to be in this hip hop game and who love it and who are willing to do things to get into it. We all did as interns, as, you know, go fetch this, go do it.
Exactly.
We've all done it to get in, but there has to be a line of professionalism, and what you've left on the table because of not crossing that line is a story that I think women and guys that are in this, who are in this realm of groupie and blah, 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 need to be aware of. Because we almost didn't have a Kanye or a John Legend or whomever.
Toya's gone. And, you know, Kylie.
But because of the mess. Because of the mess, though. Like, not because of their talent, not because of what they did, but because of the extras that were sprinkled on top of it. And that's a heartbreaker for the story, for the culture.
We can have fun. You know, we played Monopoly in the studio when I made the brand new reunion album. You know, we played marathon Monopoly games. I mean, it's a fun business. Like, I'm all for having fun. Like, you know, I just like the toxic stuff. Like, and it's really so important what you guys are doing because it's about the good guys speaking out. Because if the good guys laugh off the, like, slightly creepy stuff that the bad guys say in front of everybody, that sends a message to the women in the room. There's nobody safe for me to turn to if this goes sideways.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a very great
Russell
point.
Russell started exposing himself to me. You know, I felt so isolated. Leor was so mean to me. I'm going to be honest with you. I reported to Baby Chris. He was the head of A&R. He didn't like me because I wasn't, like, hired by him. I was hired by Russell. And so I felt like everybody hated me. I thought everybody wanted me to lose. They thought, like, I couldn't do this. What, you know, I was too, all the things I was too, whatever, to be good at this, and I knew that I could do it. And I felt so isolated. And the guys who were the good guys, who some of them have reached out to me, you know, if they said one thing one time in a room in front of him, I might have told them, but I couldn't tell. You know, I couldn't tell who was safe.
Silence is backing it. I mean, that's what we've seen about a lot of things. Silence is kind of a vote of approval. So I could talk to you forever, but I will. But I want to make sure that we get back on time. So I do want to tell everybody it is on HBO Max exclusively, and it is an incredible thing as far as the story of hip hop and where we just don't need to be. And I think it's a story that needs to be told. So it's on the record. It covers a few different stories and just a lot of the annals of hip hop. So, Drew, I do appreciate you sharing this story for the audience here in Tampa and abroad so they could hear what it is that you went through.
Well, I was so nervous. This was so fun that I just kept talking. I could talk.
No worries at all. I mean, we got a break here, but I do appreciate you. And I'm going to reach back out to Ryan so we could get back on and just have an unadulterated conversation soon about just the vibe and just everything, just because I think the story is a lot bigger than we'll be able to give it. All right. So I do appreciate you checking in with us this morning. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you guys, all of you, for having me.
Thank you.
All right, Drew Dixon, we appreciate you. That is major right there. That's, man, that's, bro, that's such an important story that when I was sitting there looking at it, I'm like, I don't know who did what, but I know that I've seen hip hop. We've all seen it backstage, and it's misogyny involved in hip hop. It's misogyny involved in rock. It's like,
accepted.
You know, and the whole Me Too thing was also Hollywood, that it wasn't really including music. And I was like, how does music be unscathed? Like, how do they get away with it? And then when this came out, I was like, you know, I mean, that's a lot of records.
Yes.
It's a lot
so
of records that were popping. So, you know, for you to walk away from the game after, that's like saying I hit three-pointers all the time. I'm Steph Curry.
Bye.
And then just like, I don't want to play them and walk away. Yeah. People are going to ask you, why'd you walk away? And you never say nothing.
Yep.
And then when you say it, they're like, are you serious? That was going on. Like, John Legend now has been made aware of why he didn't get signed. And he was like, that's what was going on when you were in there in the office and you came out and you said, no, not today. That was because you wouldn't. They were asking you to do that to get me in the room. How crazy is that?
Mind blown.
That's absolutely nuts. So, you know, the crazy with the phone thing, because she said she had lost some sort of tower or whatever. So they had fuzz. So, I mean, we had to sit through that. But it's something that's definitely necessary. So wanted to get that in. Definitely going to have her back so we can get the Zoom thing going.
I'll put this audio up on our website a little bit later today if you want to hear.
We'll have the producers have to like filter it or something.
Yeah.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.